Session number 3178, reel number 4. Sir Geoffrey Tuttle, reel 4.
When you returned from this period of leave in England, you were given a new appointment away from Karachi. Now, what was that?
I was given command of a flight in 5 Squadron, which was reassembling on a grass airfield outside Rawalpindi, having survived the earthquake in Quetta, and I was given the survivors, or the squadron was given the survivors and some new people, because there had been heavy casualties, and of course there were, all the aircraft were new, because all the aircraft 5 Squadron had been destroyed in the Quetta earthquake. We took turns at sending flights to the into the tribal territory on the frontier of India. And on 3 occasions, I was lucky enough to command a flight. I normally volunteered to do the married officer's job up there, because it was tremendous fun having your own fort, your own airmen, your own aircraft, and your own war.
How did you find that the survivors of the earthquake at Quetta had been affected by the experience?
I thought originally there was no effect at all, but it so happened that one day I was sitting in my bath, and the water started to dash about and run over each end, and I then realized something unusual was happening, got out, put a towel on, and went outside. It was an earthquake. The interesting thing was that all the men who had previously been through the Quetta earthquake and buried were standing in the middle of the tennis court, very wisely, but they really weren't frightened, and I don't blame them at all. I luckily only just realized that what I had just had was a minor earthquake.
Let's divide the kind of work that you did in your squadron into two parts. First of all, the Army Corporation kind of work, and then the independent air action. Mm. What kind of things did you do in cooperation with columns of troops at that time?
There were really three things we did. First of all, there was artillery spotting for the guns, and we used a code for that. We had by then some radio which rarely worked, but most of that was done by radio, and we would tell them where their shots were falling, having been told what the target was. They could, if they wanted to talk to us, normally it was done by message picking up and message dropping. The aircraft were fitted with a hook. They would put a message on a piece of string between two posts, and you would fly low enough between it to pick up the message. To give them a message back, you dropped it with a coloured streamer on. It worked extremely well. Sometimes it was not easy to pick up the message because of the mountainous nature of the country. The other things we did were practice bombing, and of course in the end we did real bombing on real people. The squadron was an Army Cooperation Squadron, and we were there to support the Army.
Did you do that in earnest or only in training? Did you see any active service with combat?
Oh yes, I had 3 separate wars while I was there. 2 of which were entirely my own, and the third one, headquarters got to hear about it and insisted on helping me when I didn't need help, to the extent that they sent a squadron leader to take over command and run a bigger affair. I think probably they were right, because that war eventually went on until almost until World War II broke out and I left India in 1937. It was against the chap who became quite famous, the Fakir of Ipi.
Did you actually go out with columns of troops in these...
Yes, when the tribesmen had been troublesome, there were two things that would normally be done. The army headquarters, which of course decided the thing, would either send out a column to march through the territory, a column of soldiers, British Army and Indian Army and Gurkhas, which we would support, and or it would be left entirely to the air. In either case, we were fully armed with live bombs to support them. The army could call for bombing of something, but if we were exercising air control, the normal thing to do was to warn the villagers that if they didn't behave themselves, and misbehaving was normally raiding a local village or town and stealing things, and sometimes cutting people's throats, you would warn them, first of all, by leaflets, that if they didn't behave, we would do something. And then, if they went on being troublesome, we would warn them that we would bomb an assembly of people. An assembly was normally defined as 10 people. And I remember in my case, of course, that the great attraction was that we wanted to bomb people. That isn't a good idea in a modern society, but I think it is important to emphasize that we were all trained as professional assassins, and we wanted to see if we could kill people. It wasn't that we didn't know them, and we weren't fighting a crusade. We were merely exercising our professional skill. Indeed, in my case, I remember eventually finding 9 people and saying, well, that's within 10%, and that's good enough, so I blew them up.
What was the point of bombing assemblies of people?
So that they could not get together to organize a bigger, organized resistance to us. So you didn't want... Their only communication was, of course, vocal. Therefore, there had to be an assembly in order to disseminate a plan.
And after bombing assemblies, what was the next stage if that didn't produce the desired effect?
Well, it was a war you, in the end, if they didn't surrender, you could never win, because they had the initiative. They were very, very brave. They didn't mind dying. And if they didn't decide to stop because they didn't want to be blown up anymore, as I said, the third one went on for 5 or 6 years in bits. Every now and again they would shoot somebody, blow something else up, raid another village. And it was a war you couldn't win, and I believe to the present day the Pakistanis can't control the area. I think it may be worth mentioning that there were two fascinating things there. They made their rifles in the well-known rifle factory out of railway lines. And I've been to the factory in a peaceful period and seen them making them, and they were an exact copy of the, I think, Lee Enfield rifle, to the extent that all the rifles had the same number. They were made of railway line, and they weren't rifled, therefore the barrels didn't last long. But I think there may be one more amusing story than that. They eventually built a cannon, and to attack another fort, not my fort, one day, they produced the cannon and put it about a mile from the fort, filled it, with gunpowder, put the cannonball in, lit the blue paper, and the shell went a mile beyond the fort. They wheeled the cannon a mile back, did it again, and blew the cannon up and killed the people trying to fire the cannon.
Did you engage in any bombing operations against native villages as well as against assemblies?
Yes, I should have said that, but if you, you eventually bombed a village instead of an assembly, was the next stage of escalating the thing to try and make them behave. But of course, the villages were pretty vulnerable, being mud huts or stone huts. But the bombs were only 250-pound bombs, so you didn't do tremendous damage.
In the first two of your wars, who were they against, and were they actually successful, this method of air control?
They were always against the tribesmen in the frontier. They were either Masuds, Pathans, Wazirs, from memory. And in the first two, I mean, the war stopped. Well, I don't think you can say you won. They gave in for a bit, and then it started up again.
Did you have to bomb their villages?
Yes, we had to bomb their villages.
Did you do that in successive days, or was it just once?
You had to give time for what you were doing to produce a reaction. And you would say, we will destroy your village, and you'd probably go on and do what you would consider destroy the village. And if that didn't do it, and they didn't stop, you would then, maybe then, the army would send a column through and we would support it. I once went through tribal territory with an army column in order to see what happened to them so that I could advise myself and my pilots any better way of doing the cooperation.
What sort of impression did you get when you were actually on foot?
The first impression was I didn't like being a soldier and I didn't like being shot at on the ground. There wasn't a lot of shooting, but there was enough to keep you awake.
Did you find you learnt anything, though, from going with the troops in any way?
Oh, yes, I think the more you know of the other person's problem, the better your cooperation. In the same way I would sometimes fly the brigadier or the colonel or company commander round so they could see how the cooperation went to my end.
Did you find you had some sympathy with the soldier's lot in the
North? Oh, yes, you'd maybe decide I never wanted to be a soldier.
What was life like for an RAF officer on the North West frontier when you weren't actually engaged in one of these wars? What was the sort of daily routine?
All the amusements were locally made. You could motor to the local town when things were calm, and I had a car up there. It actually was a Bentley because I could afford to run a car on my pay then. I ran a Bentley on my pay. You could do that in normal times. There were tennis courts, there was a squash court, there was an absolutely ghastly swimming pool, which we used to play the soldiers' water polo, but there were far more frogs in the pool than there were soldiers or airmen. The food was perfectly reasonable. There was plenty of staff to look after you. I mean, we all had our own bearer, and there were cooks and gardeners and so on. And we could go, now and again, we would go to dinner with a regiment in another fort. But normally then you would stay the night. It wasn't wise to go motoring at night.
You were much better off financially, were you, in India than you had been in England?
I don't think so. I don't believe until after the war, World War II I'm talking about, it ever occurred to me, or most other people, whether they were well or badly off. We were always hard up. But by modern standards, we certainly weren't hard up.
But you were able to run a car.
I went shooting in Kashmir. I went shooting crocodile down the Indus, and I ran a Bentley, all on my pay. And I don't think that would be possible these days.
Did you do any other things when you were... Did you have a reasonable amount of leave when you were in India?
We had 2 months a year, which was plenty. I didn't take it all because life was such fun, you didn't need any leave. I took 2 months in Kashmir shooting, and 2 months, of course, when I came home on leave.
Did you see anything while you were in India at the beginnings of the Indian Air Force?
The Indian Air Force was formed, from memory, in 1934 at Karachi when I was there, under someone who is now Air Marshal Sir Cecil Boucher, and whom I saw recently in Japan. He is presumably about 84 now. It caused quite a sensation to be told that the Indian Air Force was forming on our station in what is now a most extraordinary way. They, of course, had airmen being trained in England, presumably at Halton. They had pilots being trained at Cranwell, and eventually the day came when they arrived. But before then, we had a series of mess meetings as to how we were to deal with the problem of having Indians in the mess. This was at a time, which is almost unbelievable now, that generally speaking, we didn't meet Indians. And they were all, remember, then Indians. Pakistan and a separate India had not been invented. And we had discussions about whether they ought to have their own crockery and cutlery, whether they would want special food. whether they wanted special arrangements in the sleeping accommodation. In the end, all worked out, of course, perfectly well, but they had their strange customs as well. One of them arrived with two wives, which is unusual on the Royal Air Force Station. Another of them brought with him a beautiful blonde English girl, which again surprised the more staid of the Royal Air Force wives. But the whole thing worked extremely well. The only really difficult thing I remember happening was it was entirely an Indian problem, which we had to handle. One of their Christian pilots, doing a low-flying attack on an Indian army company, went too low and hit the company with his aircraft and decapitated a number of them. They were Muslim. And that actually produced an extremely difficult situation because you had a Christian pilot killing a lot of Muslims. And that transcended the fact that 13 people had been killed. That, as I say, produced an unusual problem for the station commander because it had never happened before. But the Indian Air Force itself shouldered that and all our many other responsibilities perfectly well. And by the time World War Two came, and ever since has shown it really is an air force, with a remarkable number of Royal Air Force customs still retained.
Was the Christian pilot actually cashiered?
Well, he left the service. I'm not quite certain what form his departure took.
You returned to England in 1937. Were you sorry to leave India?
Very sorry indeed. I had volunteered to go. I never regretted volunteering, and I was very sorry to leave because I like India, I like the Indians, and I love the job. I returned to England and was promoted to squadron leader and given command of a bomber squadron in the expansion program. It was 105 Squadron, which was reformed, having been disbanded in 1918. So we had some time to find its history. It was reformed at Harwell, which was one of the many brand new Royal Air Force stations being built to a very, very high standard. But of course there were no runways, it was all grass. And we were given four Audax aircraft to start with, eventually re-equipped with Fairey Battles. I was given 12 pilot officers, all brand new, about 50 airmen, all brand new, and a disciplinarian flight sergeant, thank God. These pilot officers were absolutely wonderful. They had joined as volunteers, they wanted to fly, they wanted to be in a squadron, and they all did exactly as they were told, because they all realized that however little I knew more than they did. And it formed a magnificent squadron. We, of course, had absolutely no doubt that we were much better than the other two squadrons on the station.
What sort of standard of training had the pilot officers reached when you got them? Had they done basic flying?
They had done basic flying. I can't remember now. There were no operational conversion units then. They were invented later. So they did their operational training in the squadron, and that's what we did primarily. And we trained as a bomber squadron. And fairly soon we got the Fairey Battle and were trained as a squadron of the Advanced Air Striking Force, which was planned to go to France on the outbreak of war, which gradually, obviously, became inevitable.
Did you have a set program of training laid down for you to follow with?
Yes, there was a standard training program laid down from group headquarters with huge numbers of charts with coloured squares on, which every pilot eventually had to fill up and pass, or fail. And we went to an annual practice camp to practice bombing. No, that was normally in what is now Lyme Bay, where they could practice with real bombs and fire real bullets out of their guns. And in the end, the squadron was sent to France.
did you feel that you were happy to be left to your own, were you left to your own devices very much as squadron leader to run the training programme?
The way it was, yes, and the group staff would come round and see how you were doing, but one's view then, as it always is of headquarters, they were never much help. We all knew much more about how to do it and where and when to do it than they did, and we were normally ahead of the training programme. I think it's worth mentioning that about when I had been there 3 years, just under 3 years, it was decided that a bomber squadron should be commanded by a wing commander. And of course, there was no acting rank. And they posted a wing commander in and offered me the job of second in command, which I refused. I didn't refuse it in any bloody-minded way, but it would have been quite unfair to the new man to have under him someone who had commanded the whole squadron and formed it for 3 years. So I decided it was the only thing to do was to go. It was lucky for me that I went, because the squadrons, when war was declared, went to France, and when it actually broke out, they were very nearly destroyed, annihilated, destroying the bridges over the River Meuse.
How adequate did you feel that the ferry battle was when you were actually training your men with it? Did it have any weak points?
I think the real weak point was that the job it was given was impossible. It was a single-engined aeroplane, but I don't think that would have mattered. Doing a low-flying attack on a bridge entirely covered and surrounded by German infantry firing at the single aircraft meant that they couldn't survive, and they were given an impossible task. But at that stage in May 1940,
did you have any problems with the engines of the ferry battle?
Yes, we had the early edition of the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, which had a habit of cutting out with remarkable frequency. On one trip, my engine cut 48 times, and I remembered after about 30, we were doing a long trip over the North Sea, simulating an attack on England. After about 30 engine cuts, my air gunner asked me if he might bail out. I advised him not to, because we were still over the sea. And also, I advised him that the engine did, when it stopped, always get going again, and we finally got back in one piece. It was a carburation problem, because I know it was cured by things called flame traps. What happened was, you would get a backfire, and it would then burn all the oncoming mixture. But it always got going again. Like most Rolls engines, it didn't fly to pieces.
Did you take part in interception exercises with fighters?
Yes, that was one of them. We would do a trip right out to Holland and come back. And the idea was, for the early warning system such as it was, to work and warn the fighters to intercept us. And that, what I imagine, although I never saw the results, was a singularly inefficient way. We would be intercepted by fighters now and again. But I would hesitate to say how efficient it was, but it was all we could do and done as well as it could be. I think one thing worth mentioning at that time was that the German air staff came over to visit England in 1938, and we and other bomber squadrons, and I believe fighter squadrons, were sent to fly past. The Wellingtons were told to fly past far enough away for the Germans not to see they hadn't got gun turrets. My ferry battles were all right because they hadn't got any wireless set and they hadn't got any guns, but that wasn't very noticeable. What is quite clear was that we in the advanced air striking force in 1938 were totally unprepared for war, and one could only say that Chamberlain was right to find any way of postponing it.
When war might have broken out in 1938 over Czechoslovakia, were you actually given orders at that time about what you should do if war happened?
No, the plans for going to France were in an embryo state, and the airfields were being selected, to which they eventually went in 1939. If it had happened in 1938, I can't remember whether we would have gone. I doubt if I was told.
in your training program was a lot of emphasis given to on navigation. Yeah.
Oh yes, you had of course a navigator, and the navigation and the bomb aiming was the main preoccupation. Eventually, some tremendous enthusiasm took place for night flying, and a lot of night flying was done. When they went to France, of course, they had to night fly with inadequate flares, and the accident rate went up very high.
What did the crew of Ferry Battle actually consist of?
It was a pilot, a navigator, and a rear gunner. Later on, they fitted an underbelly gun, and I believe a fourth crew member, but that was too late anyway. But we didn't have them.
How did you find that things like drinking and so on compared in your bomber squadron now in the late 1930s with your first fighter squadron in the 1920s? The atmosphere changed at all?
The atmosphere was very different. I mean, that people still drank quite a bit. I, without wishing to appear pious, I was still a teetotaler, but I wasn't a demanding squadron commander from their point of view, and I allowed my people to drink. They never overdid it. We had the usual hearty guest nights and so on, but there was much more discipline in what was, of course, 30 years after World War I than there was 7 years after World War I. We had new set of squadron commanders, new aircraft, and so on. The whole thing was better, and you had an obvious war turning up, so you needed to be efficient.
Do you think you did get your squadron into being the best on the station?
No, not only that, it was the best in the group. I'm quite certain of that, and so were all the others.